Hopkins, if you like, charging nature with this supernatural presence, was merely rediscovering and representing medieval Catholic philosophy. Go.
Welcome to Faith and Culture, a production of the Augustine Institute. Every week, we explore the glory of the Catholic faith and the beauty of Catholic culture. And now, here's the host of Faith and Culture, Joseph Pierce.
Hello, I'm Joseph Pierce, and welcome to another Faith and Culture podcast with the Augustine Institute. Today, I would like to continue the talk that I'm giving on the Catholic literary revival. So in the first of the talks, I gave the background to the revival and then what I call the gestation period of the Catholic literary revival, which was the period from 1798 to 1845, the period of the romantic reaction to the secularism and materialism of the Enlightenment of the 18th century, and the various manifestations of neo-medievalism that arose from that romantic reaction, specifically the Gothic Revival, especially in architecture, the Pre-Raphaelite movement in the visual arts and literature, and most importantly, the Oxford movement, which in terms of ecclesiology and theology led to the conversion of John Henry Newman, who was received into the church in 1845. And that is the date I give as the birthday, if you like, the date of birth of the Catholic literary revival following that 47-year gestation period. So 1845 is the definitive date of the birth of the Catholic literary revival, purely on the basis of the conversion of John Henry Newman, because it's difficult for us to really appreciate the impact of Newman's conversion. Newman was so respected and revered by his peers as being a great intellect, as being also a very holy man, a very articulate man, a man that, who is described as one of the great, and perhaps the greatest of prose stylists of the Victorian era, a man extraordinarily gifted. So when Newman is received into the church, it sends shockwaves through the establishment, because Catholicism by this stage, you know, had been so marginalized in England that it was really seen now as a foreign religion, that Catholicism was okay for those swarthy people to the south, maybe the sort of primitive type religion for a primitive people such as the Italians and the Spanish, the Portuguese, but not for enlightened Englishmen. So this sort of supercilious, bigoted arrogance that prevailed in English culture. Well, when Newman became a Catholic and was received into the church, it blew that away, because this was a very articulate, intelligent man who could not be dismissed for his ignorance or his prejudice or his bigotry or his superstition. This was a man who understood history, theology, philosophy, could articulate it either from the pulpit or with the written word. So in Newman's wake, many other people followed in his footsteps. And there was a wave of converts to the Catholic faith from the higher echelons of society, both in terms of being members of the ruling class, the aristocracy, and also from the being members of the intelligentsia. So, you know, there was this sort of position where, you know, Lord so-and-so is being received into the church this week, and there's some major thinker the following week, and so all of a sudden Catholicism has become de rigueur. It's become sort of fashionable, and many people are being received into the church. Now, simultaneously, I would say providentially, 1845 also happens to be the date of the Irish potato famine. Now, one consequence of that, of course, is that many Irish people, to escape starvation and penury, left Ireland and became part of that great Irish diaspora, which has spread throughout the world. Now, of course, many Irish people came over to the United States, and the Irish American community is the fruit and consequence of that. But many more actually also went to England. So almost overnight, 1845, you had two things going on. It might be called a pincer movement on behalf of the Catholic Church. In the higher levels of society, we have these fashionable converts and these intellectual converts and these aristocratic converts to the faith, all following in John Henry Newman's footsteps. But then we also had at the same time a new working class Irish Catholic proletariat. New Catholic churches were being built around the country. So almost overnight, from 1845 onwards, we have the sudden resurgence of the presence of Catholicism in English culture, both at the highest levels and at the levels of the working class. So so this period, then I call the Newman period, from 1845 until 1890, the date of Newman's death. Newman produced many wonderful works in various different areas of study. So as a writer of literature, he wrote a novel shortly after his reception to the church. In 1848, he published a novel called Loss and Gain, which is set in Oxford and basically is a quasi-autobiographical account of Newman's own intellectual and spiritual journey from being sort of a low church, evangelical, Protestant member of the Anglican Church to becoming an Anglo-Catholic, and finally to his being received into the church, and various characters interacting with the protagonist with their own perspective on things. So it's very much an intellectual novel rooted in ideas, but nonetheless a beautiful, beautiful novel. Newman would write one other novel called Callista, which is a tale of the catacombs, so a tale about the early church, a historical novel. He wrote poetry, some wonderful poetry, my favourite of which is a poem called The Pilgrim Queen, and that's about the Blessed Virgin, but particularly about the Blessed Virgin who's been exiled from her own England. And she reminds me very much of Our Lady of Walsingham, whom we alluded to in the first talk on this revival, an apparition in England dating back to 1061. So the Pilgrim Queen, very almost medieval in its form and in the atmosphere it evokes of a merry England of the past that Newman obviously hoped would be a merry England of the future. Other poetry, he wrote a poem called The Golden Prison about purgatory. So many of Newman's always a teacher and a preacher, so even this poetry we see his teaching Catholic doctrine to particularly the most controversial aspects of Catholic doctrine from the perspective of an anti-Catholic Protestant rejection of Catholicism. So The Golden Prison was about purgatory. There's a poem called The Sign of the Cross about the power of the Sign of the Cross as a prayer to exorcise evil, to encourage the faithful. But Newman's best known poem is The Dream of Gerontius, a longer, more ambitious poem, similar in theme at least to works such as Dante's Divine Comedy. So it's a poem about the afterlife, what happens after death, and the experience of the soul transitioning from this life to purgatory. With choirs of angels and what have you. He also, of course, wrote some wonderful hymns. Lead Kindly Light perhaps springs to mind. He also, however, wrote a great philosophical work called The Grammar of Assent. He wrote a great theological work, an essay on the development of doctrine. And his published sermons also. So this man was a giant. Now, in 1866, Newman received into the Catholic Church in Oxford a young man whose name was Gerard Manley Hopkins. Now, Hopkins would go on to become a Jesuit priest. And I won't say more important than that, but as important than that, he became arguably the finest poet of the Victorian era. Now, Chesterton wrote a book called The Victorian Age in Literature, and it would be true to say that the Victorian Age in Literature is a golden age in literature. Some of the greatest writers in the English language were writing during the reign of Queen Victoria, which began in 1837 and ended in 1901. So to be able to say that that Hopkins was the greatest poet of that golden age really is saying something very special. But I think it's true. Hopkins basically was ahead of his time. Now, I'm always suspicious of anybody that's being called ahead of his time. And so you might be wondering why I'm appending that particular phrase to Hopkins as being ahead of his time. Well, when that phrase is usually used, it's usually used because someone is thought of as being up to date or fashionable. But C.S. Lewis reminds us, fashions are always coming and going, but mostly going. And that's because those things that are most up to date are the things that very soonest go out of date. So most writers that were considered to be ahead of their time are in fact largely forgotten. But Hopkins, on the other hand, the reason this is true of him was that his poetry was considered so difficult in his own time that virtually none of it was ever published. Even his friends and admirers could not understand much of his poetry. One of them said that Hopkins's poetry contains priceless gems embedded in impracticable quartz. In other words, you know, it's like mining and you find these beautiful diamonds, these wonderful lines of sheer beauty in the midst of a rock which is impenetrable, which is you can't decipher or understand. Well, if that's true, then he's not a great poet. Because you have to be able to communicate. All poetry has to communicate. But in Hopkins's case, so he dies unknown, certainly unknown as a poet, and his poetry is not published until the end of World War One, when his friend Robert Bridges edits a volume of Hopkins's poetry and publishes it. And then in the interwar years between World War One and World War Two, in the 1920s, especially in the 1930s, Hopkins becomes one of the most influential of the so-called modern poets, of the poetic avant-garde. So in other words, he's considered to be at the head of his time, but he's ahead of his time 30 or 40 years after his death. Now, that is something most people cannot claim. To be seen as a modern poet 30 or 40 years after you've died. So what was it about Hopkins that was so different or new? Well, Hopkins plays the game of what I call leapfrog with history. We talked about this in the last talk with regard to the neo-medievalists who leapfrogged over the period of the Enlightenment and the period of the Reformation and rediscovered the Middle Ages, rediscovered the medieval. Hopkins did the same thing. So the various aspects of Hopkins's poetry that were thought to be ahead of their time and avant-garde and cutting edge were in actual fact the consequence of Hopkins leapfrogging over the whole period of modern poetry. So the poetry that begins, if you like, you know, the forms of poetry with regular metrics, regular rhyme, the sort of poetry which we've all come to know as traditional, really begins in the early modern period in the 16th century. Hopkins leapfrogs over the whole of that and rediscovers older forms of rhythm and older types of poetic form. So, for instance, his poetry is full of the sort of irregular rhythm that you'll find in Gregorian chant, for instance. So, in the liturgy of the church, that beautiful rhythm of Gregorian chant, he rediscovered and reintroduced the rhythm of nursery rhymes, where you have the same rhythm in every line, but a different number of syllables. Okay, so for instance, three blind mice, see how they run, see how they run. La 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 la. Three blind mice, three blind mice. So again, there's only three beats to every line there, but the number of syllables changes tremendously. So rediscovering this way of creating rhythm and regularity in verse, he also rediscovered the rhythms of Anglo-Saxon poetry, the poetry of Old England, of Old English poetry, where it wasn't the number of syllables on the line that mattered, it was the number of stressed syllables on the line, in each line that mattered. So again, he was emulating this older medieval Old English poetry of the Anglo-Saxons and rediscovering that and reintroducing that. And then within his poetry, you had the concept of something called inscape, which was seen as being very new, this idea of inscape. In actual fact, all that Hopkins was doing with inscape, which is basically seeing the presence of the supernatural and specifically the presence of the divine, of the metaphysical within physical reality. So you look at a tree and it's not just something which is purely physical, something which is purely made up of certain atoms, but is something which has a spiritual being, a spiritual essence, if like the presence of the divine within it. So he saw this, he called it inscape. In actual fact, that was his word for something which the medieval philosophers called heiceitas or heiceitas, depending upon how you want to pronounce it, thisness in Latin. Now, this was something that was put forth by Blessed Duns Scotus, the Franciscan scholastic philosopher of the Middle Ages. So Hopkins, if you like, in charging nature with this supernatural presence was merely really rediscovering and representing medieval Catholic philosophy and doing it in such a way that everybody thought it was new because, of course, they were ignorant of medieval Catholic philosophy. So he writes, the world is charged with the grandeur of God. So within every single living thing, every single thing within creation, be it a tree or a bird or a human being or even an event in history. So Hopkins's poem, probably his masterwork, The Wreck of the Deutschland, is about the divine presence, God's presence in an historical event, in this case, a shipwreck. So the world being charged with God's grandeur through God's presence, Blessed Duns Scotus called heiceitas, Hopkins calls inscape. Hopkins also talks about in stress, which is the moment when the human soul, human perception, becomes aware of that inscape. In other words, becomes aware of that divine presence in creation. As we said in the last talk, as Samuel Taylor Coleridge had done when he witnessed the sun rising above Mont Blanc in the Alps and was lifted up in poetry and praise and prayer to the glory of God's presence in the beauty of that moment. So this was the eureka moment, the moment of recognition of God's presence in things. This was what Hopkins called in stress. All of these revolutionary ideas, which years, decades after Hopkins' death, would be seen as very avant-garde by the 20th century. So Hopkins was the greatest and most powerful presence in terms of literature in the Catholic literary revival, apart from Newman himself, during that Newman period between 1845, the date of Newman's conversion and reception to the church, and until the date of his death in 1890. Perhaps in passing, we can mention the poet Coventry Patmore, who was a friend of Hopkins's, a convert to the faith, a poet that used to be very popular, now largely and sadly forgotten by many. Very influential upon the young C.S. Lewis, amongst other things. I would recommend his poetry in general. Two poems, that one called The Toys and one called Magna Est Veritas, in particular. So this takes us from that second period, the period from the birth of the Catholic revival with Newman's conversion in 1845, to the period of 1890, the date of his death. In the next talk on the Catholic revival, the Catholic literary revival, we would talk about what I call the decadent interlude between 1890, the death of John Henry Newman, blessed John Henry Newman now, of course, and the death of Oscar Wilde. So please join me for the next talk on the history of the Catholic literary revival. I'm Joseph Pierce, and you've been listening to another Faith and Culture podcast of the Augustine Institute. Thanks so much for listening. God bless and goodbye. Go.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Faith and Culture with Joseph Pierce. Faith and Culture is a production of the Augustine Institute. For more information, please visit us at faithandculture.com.